Thank you for that amazing, amazing lecture. I'm completely emotionally overwhelmed by hearing about your work. Almost unexpectedly, the sweeper from like just I'm here in 1968, and then I'm in the 2000s, and it all it also feels incredibly current and of its time now, so which I think is really interesting. And then just before I ask the questions over to the audience, I just wanted to ask something about this, coming back to the body, but whether it's become less painful. Because at the beginning of the talk, we talked about how painful the body was. And then we come back in and out of your body, the feminine body. And has that now, at this stage, is it less painful?
Actually, that's quite an interesting question, because when I actually came to my own body in the 90s, it was because of pain. Because I had actually hurt my, seriously injured my back, and I had a damaged nerve. And so I experienced the body in a completely direct way, you know, which, I mean, pain is always the strongest experience of any, really. It's even almost stronger than extreme pleasure. And it kind of focused my mind on my own body, and I also thought of it as fragmented, not a whole, you know, a fragmented shell. And of course, I've been interested in Buddhism for quite a long time, and although I'm not a Buddhist or anything like that, but I've been interested in it, and the Buddhists do talk about the body as a shell. And I've always found that quite interesting, that the empty shell, because of course an atom is like, we think of an atom as a shell with the electrons moving around the shell of the atom, which of course is just an idea, it isn't really a shell. But so it's an interesting thing that it was actually pain that brought me back to the idea of body.
And by working through it in your practice, does that change your relationship with your body or the cosmos? Or how has that changed over here?
Well, I think, yeah, I think there's, you know, change is constant. You know, I always feel, I'm not saying that I always feel pain.
No.
I mean, you know, it's just, pain is just, also pain is also just a stimuli. No, I mean, of course it's awful, but it is just a stimuli. It's just information, just like everything.
Yeah. I want to ask. I'm sure people have got questions. I want to. We've got the mic.
Oh, I'm going to start. I just want to ask. What do you experience when you see light interacting in your work or in your work?
God, I can't hear.
What do you experience when you see light in your work and interacting in your work?
How do I interact with my own work?
How you interpret, like, when you see the light in your work.
Oh, the light, this light.
In any of it, because I see a lot of light running through your work, and I was just wondering what's your... You're obviously very interested in it.
Well, I always find light exciting, you know. You know that all information is contained in light. And matter is light, basically. I mean, if you like, a form of light. It's light that goes slower than the speed of light is, in a sense, transformed into matter. So that there's this continuity, and I always find it really exciting to experience light. I mean, light of any kind, luminosity.
Mm-hmm. really interesting. I'm really interested in the idea of matter and light, and I was thinking about a possible question. Then it came up then, so I kind of thought I'd go and just see how I ended up asking it in the end. But there seems to be something about this exposing of invisible potential that's not quite there. And it's in the materiality of using things other than flesh to expose, to explore the body, and then there's the idea of finding this quality of light that's not there until your intervention. It seems to be your intervention as an artist is finding these qualities that aren't otherwise accessible. And I kind of wondered whether that was something conscious, and if so, what is the drive to do that? Or if it's even something that you consider to be there, this kind of universal potential, but we're only getting fragments of until you intervene.
I lost the last bit of that. Sorry. I mean, I got everything except the last three or four words.
Say it exactly as you said it. It's really clear. Just say louder.
There's kind of a universal potential that we're only kind of getting to see in fragments until you intervene with it. I can't remember how
that
worked.
It's
on
the end, isn't it?
I'm not quite sure how to ask what I wanted to.
So. Okay, no, I understood what you're saying. I think, you know, it's all really about looking, you know, and when you. It's really about observing, you know, looking and being focused on what you're looking at. And so if you're working like, well, I, you know, work with materials, obviously, any material, you know, you observe them, and then it's as if they speak to you, really. I sort of think of things, I mean, sounds a bit funny, but I really do think things speak, you know, and when you work with a material, any kind of material, it has a way of talking to you. If it doesn't talk to you, don't work with it. But it's following that, catching and following, and then, you know, it may result in something extraordinary, maybe not, you know.
You seem to have like a really particular understanding of material where when I'm looking at you, I don't really see a distinction between the mental, the bodily, the physical. It kind of, you seem to have this unity within it all. Is there something that you feel unites it all, or is it just matter?
Oh, no, I think there is. I mean, of course I think there is something that unites it, but I don't think it's anything. It's very hard to explain, actually, you know. I mean, physicists talk about it with numbers, you know, with math. I'm not a mathematician, so I talk about it with my work, you know. And to speak about it is really difficult because we don't really have the right language. It's finding the right language, the right words to explain, to even come close to understanding why, you know, what is the connective tissue, if you like, the universal connective tissue. There probably is some kind of connective tissue, but, you know, I don't know what it is.
If anything, that's probably a testament to the work that these questions are even coming up, because it's not really something that we would have processed.
No, I mean, I could not begin to explain it. But in even in physics, nobody really knows. You know. It's amazing, actually, when you know. I started being part of a residency in Paris that Laura mentioned, and it's called Universe 2, because the man who started this, whose name was Pierre Bientrot, and he died. It was extraordinary. He got funding for this and then got terrible cancer, and within 3 months he was gone. But they decided to keep going, you know, keep it, do it. And they just got a bunch of artists, three or four artists, and some physicists, and this composer. There are a few people, and the idea was to somehow have a some kind of interchange of ideas, and then maybe come up with some work. And there have been a couple of sessions. And they've been very, very interesting because, in a way, although they're very different languages, and it's quite difficult to follow, I mean, you know, cutting edge science, particularly this is astrophysics, so, and what they're looking at is gravity, and that's why they call it Universe 2, because they've captured, they've actually captured, if you like, it's not the right word, but been able to receive gravitational waves from two huge cataclysm of two black holes. I don't know, I can't remember how many thousands, millions of years ago. It's sort of incredible. And the extraordinary thing about it is that they're actually looking at the Big Bang, you know, at the beginning, supposedly, and they can't see it because light doesn't come out of that, because it's not there's no formation of photons, so because there are no photons, you can't actually receive the light from that, and that's the way we perceive everything, is through light. But gravity is another way in which you can receive information, and gravity will actually go that far. So we can get gravitational waves from right at the beginning of time. That's a way of putting it. So imagine that. I mean, you know, the concept of actually, you know, receiving information from the beginning of time through gravitational waves changes everything, and that's why they called it Universe 2.
Thank you. That was a lovely answer. Can you extend that answer to talk a little bit about how you have those conversations with very different languages, with the very different language, with the scientists? How do you find the center ground to do present ideas to them? Does it evolve out of conversations? There's some visuals. Can you talk a bit about that very interesting process?
Well, it depends. I mean, in this particular case, what we've done is that the scientists will actually present their research, but, you know, quite, you know, they'll do it in a way that can be understood by people who don't have a huge, I'd say almost no maths, you know. So, you know, otherwise they would be just putting formulas down. But they actually, you know, speak French or English, actually mainly French, and they talk about their research. And they, for example, they spent a couple of hours explaining, or 2 or 3 hour morning, explaining this research into gravitational waves and what it would mean. Then there was another talk that was very interesting, given by a woman who was, I think, also a physicist, and she spoke about shadows. And I thought that was fascinating because, you know, I was very interested in shadows. It was sort of the beginning of my work was all about shadows. And so to hear it from a scientific point of view was fascinating because, of course, they get a huge amount of information from shadows. So, you know, so not only light, but shadow. What is occluded? What is not there? What is not visible? So what the artists who were there did, and what I did, was to give a talk about my work, a bit like what I did now, but usually more directed. I mean, I just gave a talk about the 2-3 projects.
So when did the two come together? That sounds fascinating.
Well, they don't necessarily come together. I mean, for example, the one project I spoke about was a new work that I'd made called Spinning Dolls. And basically what I did was take material. I did it actually for a textile museum. That was the wonderful name, the Museum of Cannabis, you know. And basically it's hemp. And so I used circular panels of cloth, like skirts, and spun them, let them spin. And actually it sounds very simple, but it's very difficult because what I wanted them to do was float, you know, lift. And because I noticed that they did do that, but not always. And so it depended very much on the speed, on, you know, the acceleration, on the cloth itself. Some cloth does do it, some cloth don't do it. So I explained all these difficulties, and hoping that maybe one of these scientists might explain why. And the funny thing was they couldn't explain why. And they, because they weren't that particular type of scientist. But they, what one of the physicists did was to send me a paper that had been written about the same topic. And so I ended up with this scientific paper on exactly, if you like, the experiment that I'd made. Which didn't enlighten me very much because A, it was all in very difficult formula, and B, it didn't actually talk about what I was interested in, which was, you know, why does this material do it and that material not, you know? I don't know if that answers your question.
Just a quick supplementary, air gel. How amazing does that sound? Material you worked with. So it's magic. So did it only really come to life when you put light on it?
No. It's interesting even without light. But what I found even more interesting was I used some doilies. You know doilies. Because it was a museum and they had all these old doilies, and they worked really well. And so I got the people in the museum to crochet a big, you know, sort of 2 meter, meter and a half, something like that, diameter, crocheted open weave, sort of circle or disc. And that was amazing. It's illogical, you know, if you think about it. It's very, you know, why does something that lifts like that, that's full of holes, and the other one doesn't? It's difficult to understand.
But through bringing those things together, I guess you're transforming all the time.
It's extraordinarily beautiful to see it lift. But also, and it looks like all kinds of different things. But you're sort of working with gravity, and at the same time, but you're working with gravity with the materials, and the subtlety of the difference in materials will change the result.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting and hard to understand.
I have two questions, if you will permit. And I think the first may be a little impertinent, but what is the song, the terrible song that you sang to Women of War?
Ah.
And
the Woman of War sings.
She sings, not you. But
well,
you
I sing
you,
through
you
her.
You sing through her. You started with you singing, and then the Woman of War sings. And then the second question is really, you talked about science fiction, and at a certain point I was thinking, really reminded very much of the fantastic work of Ursula Le Guin and of Octavia Butler, both no longer with us, but how in their work as feminist science fiction writers, the bodies change, are mutable, are assumed, are differently sexed, of other bodies.
Mm.
And that seemed to play out, that. So I just wondered if you were reading people like Le Guin.
Oh yeah, well I've read Le Guin, but I've not read...
Octavia Butler, she rocks. She's very... she died recently, but she's in her 90s. She's an African-American science fiction
novel
writer. So
that sounds very interesting. I'd like to read that. No, Ursula Le Guin I have read, and I read her quite a long time ago. But I found her rather kind of masculine. Her female characters
she
were always...
She apologizes for that.
She does.
Later, she talks, she self-critiques.
Ah, I didn't know that. But of course, you know, maybe it's her, you know, the period that she lived in and all that. But I did feel that. The other question that I wanted to, that you've asked, the Lady of the Wild Things responds to sound. I made her first, so that sculpture I made first, and I was doing a lot of performing from Crossing Map, and so I would sing from Crossing Map to the sculpture, and she would perform, she would light up. And she was actually made to respond to my voice. I mean, you can do that, and she'll light up. But with my voice, it's more complex, more subtle. She has about 12 different channels, and so it's tone, well, pitch and volume, but pitch and volume. So a little bit more complex.
And what is that voice?
And then with the Woman of War, I was giving a performance at the Pompidou Center, and this was in 1984. And from Crossing Map, which is what I would sing parts of, and just sort of walking, coming back from the performance, walking in the street, going back home, I had this sort of song in my head that had nothing to do with the book. And it was just a melody and words, and I just kept repeating it so I wouldn't forget it. And then when I got back, I wrote it down, and then I started trying to understand what it meant, you know, what it meant, like what I was supposed to do with this, you know. I wasn't a pop singer, and then I thought, well, maybe I was a pop singer. And I remembered that when I was a kid, I actually loved singing. You know, and that my first ambition had been to be a jazz singer, you see. But that was kind of ruled out by my parents, who were terrified of me becoming a sort of habitué of clubs and things. And so I didn't, you know, use my voice, which is what I had wanted to do. And then, oddly enough, through this song, I started thinking, well, maybe it's a sculpture, maybe it's the song of a sculpture. And so I made the sculpture in the image of the song, which is unusual, because normally it would be the opposite way. You'd make a sculpture and then put a song into it. I didn't do that. You know, the song came first, and the sculpture actually follows. You know, it does what the song says it will do. You know. I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, I was thinking what the voice does, and at the psychoanalyst Kathleen Venier works with premature babies in the Parisian hospital, and one of the things Kathleen does is talk. She'll spend the night singing and talking to them, tiny, tiny little things, and she says, well, what the voice does is keep them in the world, stops them departing.
Well, that happens.
This voice, this thread of the voice.
Sometimes people in coma can be brought out with voice. Yeah. Well, I know that, I mean, I had a pretty nasty illness, and recovering, I just wanted to listen to music all the time. So I think, you know, sound, music is incredibly healing. Yeah. Especially the human voice, but it depends on which voice. I mean, there are voices and voices, you know.
Hi. Early on, to begin with, you mentioned that at the start of your talk, that while your contemporaries were looking at the body, you decided to delve into your mind. And I'm wondering if there's, in particular in terms of making work, I'm wondering if there's a reaction to feminist art in the 70s that you avoided for a particular reason.
No, it was the beginning of the 60s. Because I took part in a couple of erotic, sensual happenings in the early 60s, 1962. And after that, I felt that that was not my path, you know. And, you know, I had friends like Carolee Schneemann and other people who really, that was their path, you know. And I just felt it wasn't my path. I didn't want, I had a kind of opposite feeling. I felt that, women's bodies had been used enough. And I didn't feel that it was an area that I was excluded from, because, you know, that was one of the areas that you could actually, if you wanted to become a dancer, a woman. I'm not now talking about an artist, I'm talking about different areas, different disciplines. And, you know, being an actress or being a dancer was a much, never easy, but, you know, it was a more normal path, a more acceptable path for women. But to become an artist, and particularly to work in three dimensions, you know, to make objects, I think in the late 50s was sort of considered not a woman's area, you know, not a feminine area.
But all that work that replaced the body and the gaze as such, it's interesting that you came back to the body much later.
Well, what I did was I explored different avenues, and when I came back towards the body, I wanted to find a new body. I didn't do it through my own body or through a body that I knew. I wanted to find a new body. And that new body that I found was part of everything. That's the actual point I'm trying to make, that it's not an individual body. It's a body that encloses everything, you know, anything you can imagine, including machines, robots, you know, the earth, anything. Oh dear. Well, okay, I have to turn this off.
It's someone asking a question. Someone asking you a question.
Should I answer?
Yeah, answer. Actually,
I missed it. Never been asked so many questions.
Keep going.
I was interested that you mentioned that the Photographic performance at the Pompidou in 1984, because in 1985 the Pompidou was an exhibition called Le Thériau, curated by François Lyotard, which was this kind of iconic art and technology exhibition that was, I'm sure you were very much aware of, but it was interesting because it was very male-centric in terms of its artists included in it. I wonder whether that was a scene that you were familiar with, or whether you felt that distinction at that point of working as a woman in technology, and that was very much a polarized realm.
I mean, you know, even in the late 60s when I worked with, I was working with technology, I tried to go to MIT. They wouldn't accept me, you know. I just couldn't, they just told me they didn't have any money, but they had money for they did have the money, because there were a lot of artists who went and worked at MIT, including my ex-husband. You know, so, but, you know, I think it was really difficult as a woman to get in, you know. And I have no idea how one did it, but it was not easy, you know, then. It wasn't, but there were women working with technology, but they were mainly working with early computing technology. And I was not working in that area. You know, so they, again, it's always very specialized. It's not, you know, it's not necessarily that you're excluded because you're a woman. It's also what exactly you're doing. You know, like, for example, you know, I worked in, I made work that was considered kinetic, right? And I was in a lot of kinetic shows. But there was a, I won't even mention the name, but there was a gallery that specialized in kinetic art, and they liked my work, at, sort of, but they thought it was too lyrical. You know, too lyrical. They wanted more, you know, what they call it. They had a wonderful word, which was reminded me of when people say it's your duty, you know. In other words, they wanted something more rigorous. Yeah, rigueur. It was in French. Un peu de rigueur. You know, in other words, you had to be, to come out of a constructivist background. It should be constructivist, it shouldn't be lyrical. You shouldn't have any poetry in it. I just found those very narrow restrictions artificial, you know, and if an artist actually does do that, restrict themselves, in psychoanalytic terms, it's called splitting off, you know. In other words, you're discarding some part of yourself, which isn't very healthy. It's not very good, I think, you know. Better to keep it all and have a bit of chaos.
I'm going to say thank you very much, and thank you very much to everyone for coming.